Good afternoon and welcome to Radio Reader Rambler, a potpourri of theater, literature, and the arts. I'm Steve Heimel sitting in for Sandy Harper and Dick Reichman. And it's so much fun to be able to do arts. The 50th year of Alaska statehood has spawned a lot of interesting projects, and one of them is a set of theatrical productions funded by the Alaska Humanities Forum. And we've been doing a series on this, and they're being done by Cyrano's Off-Center Playhouse. The show we're going to talk about this time is called Time Immemorial, and the writers and actors, even though it has an enormous cast, are with us right now. Welcome, Allison Wharton and Jack Dalton.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
So, Time Immemorial. This is statehood from an Alaska Native perspective, I would assume.
Well, which is that's a really interesting way of putting it, because that's the way it was when Sandy first approached me about the project. She said, "We want the Native view of statehood." So I sat there and thinking to myself, I have no idea what the Native view of statehood is. There are too many views to have a Native view of statehood. I mean, we can't even agree on a whole lot of things when we get togethers. But so I went to Allison and said, "What is your feeling on this?" And that's where the play, the story actually stemmed from.
And I was thinking, well, when I think of statehood, I think of in a whole history of a people, you know, if we've been here for, you know, 10,000 years or more, statehood is just really a small little portion of our history or a blip on our map.
Fascinating. So, okay, now we're down to statehood is a blip.
Exactly. Take that.
So how can you write a play about that?
Well, we just put one scene, really, that focused on statehood, but we also layered Jack wrote that scene, and he was brilliant in layering a lot of different issues into that one scene, so it didn't just touch on the impact of statehood.
But we are following the grant, so it said not just Alaska statehood, but also the history of Alaska and its peoples. So just no one get worried about out there. The money is not being spent, you know, needlessly.
No. So in a sense, the Alaska statehood portion of it, the part of it that directly deals with the period of statehood, is a small part of the play and like a scene of it.
Yes, exactly.
A play within a play, as it were.
Right, right. And you see some of the things that were brought up in statehood, which, funny enough, we didn't plan on having a statehood scene in the play. That was added later on when we realized that, wow, some of these issues, like in ANCSA, like in ANWR, like with the drugs and alcohol abuse, these things didn't get their start, but statehood had a lot to do with it. And so the specific scene in statehood deals with the idea of who are the Native peoples going to be talking to now. Before it was the Bureau of Native Affairs over in D.C., or it was the United Nations, which at the time was down in San Francisco. So these far-flung places, which had its pluses and minuses. And now we're dealing with, after statehood, a more local government and the pluses and minuses in terms of getting issues through to that body of government.
Okay, well, there is a third person involved in this production. I assume there's actually more, but your director is Princess Lukai. And can you tell me a little bit about her, being as how she's not here to describe her
I've
part
known
in this?
Princess for maybe 20 years now. We were in a play together, actually, when we were teenagers in Fairbanks called Athabascan Experience. And I'm friends with her family. I know her brothers. She's Gwich'in Athabascan, and her family's from Arctic Village. She's been living in L.A. for the past 7 years, and she works primarily in film as her medium. She's actually in New York City right now. She had one of her short films being shown at the Native film festival that they have every year. And
yeah, I think that the Smithsonian has a museum up in New York. Yeah.
So she's returning. Coincidentally, coming to this project is her return back to Alaska. And she's moving up to Fairbanks, and one of her other brothers is moving back to Fairbanks as well. And so it's nice to have her back to Alaska. While she was in L.A., she does do some work with the Native Voices at the Autry, some direction there. And it's just been she's incredibly talented and skilled as a director. We've been really blessed to have her. So we wish she was here today, but she's flying in the air, hopefully now on her way back to us.
Yeah, volcano permitting, huh?
Yes.
Be quiet, readout. We have to have our director back.
And opening night is when?
Good Friday, April 10th. Yes,
oh, it's coming right up.
Exactly. So it's we're going to be following in the footsteps of such great Alaskan events as the 64 quake and the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Woohoo!
Wow. Yeah. Well, okay, so here's the play. It's time immemorial. I think it seems to me it's thoroughly legitimate to say statehood is but a blip in the history of Alaskan Native people. I mean, that's just simply true. Why not structure the play that way? Makes all kinds of sense. So what happens all the rest of the time then, I guess I would say?
Well,
you got 10,000 years here. You're
yeah,
going to
do
it in one night.
And the thing is, we had to make choices, and they were, you know, we couldn't cover everything, obviously, or we'd be there for hours.
10,000 years.
Yeah, so we have a creation scene and a recreation scene that kind of bookmark the ends of the play. And in between, we have scenes covering like pre-contact, missionaries, boarding school, and so forth. Jack and I sat down and like, well, what are the events that most impacted us or in our thoughts
and
as
so
Native
you,
people?
You essentially, you are the actors, but there are different characters you're going to play in different eras. And yet, at the same time, you're going to retain a certain identity or a spirit identity? Or how, tell me about that.
Oh, yeah, we're getting really... So, yes, all these different characters. So all of us, like, you know, have different personalities in our minds and different ways that we handle things in different situations. And that kind of comes through in these myriad of characters that we have. And the thing is there's the tradition of naming within a lot of Alaska Native cultures where when someone passes away, the next child born is given the name of that person who passed away. And it's not necessarily a blood relative. It can be just someone in the village. And
sometimes it can be just the way that a person moves or something or a certain regard they have for a certain animal or something like that. Oh, well, you're so and so.
Yeah,
everybody will agree.
There's times when an elder will come up to a baby and go, "How dare you! Are we've been waiting for you. Welcome back." And so taking this idea, we decided to have these two characters. And then it was a matter of figuring out, okay, what are these two characters based upon? And that's when we went to the creation legends. And in the creation legends, there's usually raven, and raven's stealing something, in this case, the light. And then we said, well, who else is really important? Another bird. And another bird that was really important was eagle. And then we noticed that these two birds and their legendary characters had very different personalities that kind of opposed each other. Raven is the fast wheeling and charming and going by the seat of his pants character, and Eagle's the very thinking ahead and making all the plans and making sure everything's taken care of.
Wait, now let me guess. No, we don't have to guess, do we?
It's actually really... This is the other interesting part.
No, guess.
Yes.
We're ready. We're ready.
Who thinks who, Steve? We're waiting.
I see. Dead air is sometimes good. And then it's called a pregnant pause. All right. I see the male character as being Raven. I see the female character as being Eagle.
Right on.
Golly. Pegged
me
right
on. Man, I'm so good. I'm
just psychic over there.
Oh, yeah.
That's it. I'm leaving.
Well, okay. So you have these two then. They're, I guess we'd say, spirits who are going to appear in different scenes, and they can sort of retain these characteristics. So then it becomes really kind of a writing challenge.
Yeah, it does.
Yes, these two characters, they're born in different relationships to each other in each of these different scenes. So let's say in the boarding school scene, they're sisters. So Jack gets to play a sister. And in the pre-contact scene, they're brothers. In other scenes, they're husband and wife or elder child and so forth. So, and that's what happens in our culture also. You don't, you know, when the child's born, they have different relationships.
And so then there's an acting challenge.
Yes.
Oh, there are some challenges involved in this little project, which I think, I mean, if either of us knew, like if someone had sat down and said, by the way, these are going to be the challenges of this project, I think we both would have been much more scared than when we entered into it. And it was like, we've both said this on numerous occasions, it's like the ancestors are speaking through us kind of thing. These are the things that they really want to have said, because we've been sitting there having deep discussions and having realizations about history and what it means to look at history from a standpoint, whether that's for us in this modern standpoint or at any time in history when you're looking at the past and making essentially judgments of what those people did at that time, the decisions they made.
Mm. Well, where does Princess come in into the process here? I mean, she's the one that sits back and says, Jack, you're just not being girly enough. I'm not buying you as a sister.
That's one thing she can say.
She's like, Jack, you must raise your voice. I'm like, is this good? I'm trying really
it's
hard.
It's worth coming to the play just for that.
So there's a dramaturg role as well as a role of a director. I guess is what I'm saying. The director has
this
thing about, this ain't working. You know, let's try and do it this way. You're figuring out maybe a little different blocking or something. Okay, let's get these people really into the where it's rendering out the intent of the playwrights, which is you.
Yes.
And that was really, I remember I was really worried about writing. I'd never written anything like this before. And so I thought, supposed to tell them where they're, you know, where we or future people acting this out, where they're supposed to be standing on the stage at this time? Is that what they're, and luckily I was down in Australia and a friend of mine said, who's been working in theater for decades, said, oh, no. You as a script writer, you give them the words. And then your director is the one who says how that's going to be brought out on the stage. And I was so relieved by that. And suddenly words flowed. The dialogue flowed out because I wasn't worried about where people were sitting or standing or what they were looking like, which is the role of the director.
And in the rehearsal process, we have like a funny thing that we do is when she needs to talk to the writers, we take off our actor hats and put on our writer hats. And then we'll talk about some wording in the script as the writers. And then we're like, okay. And then we'll put our actor hats back on and we're ready back for direction. And so it's been fun and funny. And then we're like, oh, the writer wants to say something, but not the actor. So
this is even worse. Her ego wants to say something. Or Raven wants to say something.
Yeah, that's been a little difficult sometimes.
Well, then, you know, there is you read Native American history. And Alaska is not an exception. It's just a little slower process than elsewhere. And it is largely a genocidal history. Maybe not successful genocide. But nonetheless, and for whatever intent, you can call it termination. You can call it
assimilation.
Disease. Yes. But it would seem that there is a sort of a dreary pattern here that would be a little depressing to have to write about.
It was a heavy process, and it was a very healing process for both of us. It was a pretty intense thing to even sit down at the table and look at, but we also felt it was very important. We felt like there was an extra added energy that was, you know, compelling us to do this work and helping us with this work.
Essentially, what it reminded us is that Each generation has a set of circumstances that they have to deal with, and then they have to make decisions based on those circumstances, and that we, as a human being sitting at this table in this time during this generation, to be able to look back at another generation and make a judgment call on whether or not what they did was right or wrong is really interesting. And what we realized is that we in this, and anyone who looks at history, does one of two things. You either idolize or you villainize the people in history.
Mm-hmm.
We rarely take into account that human being and their, you know, funny enough, we were doing the sound check and what did you eat for breakfast? We don't take into account what they ate for breakfast. And how did, and in the terms of these people in Alaska Native Pass, how did they get that breakfast? They had to go out and hunt and da, 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 all these things that, that we don't take into account because we're looking at a set of facts and a set of, you know, usually the body count. And then we make a decision based on, okay, here are the facts, here's the body count, is what they did right or wrong? And we can say all we want, that was right or that was wrong, but until you recognize that that person is a human being who has feelings and who has loved ones and is making a decision. That it's, and that's what we're trying to capture in this play, is that these people are human beings and these people made decisions, and it's not our job to judge. It's our job to accept and
forgive.
Forgive. That's what we really came to, is a sense of forgiveness. Because, yeah, we're dealing with some stuff. But one of the most important things my grandfather said to me after I met him and before he died was never tell them we were forced. And it took me a long time to figure out what he meant by that. And then I realized what he meant was, don't tell them we were forced to become Christians. Tell them that we made a choice. And the reason I believe he wanted it that way is so that we were not victimized by those choices. That if we had the power to make the choice back then we have the power now to make whatever choice there is in the future, including the choices and some very tough choices we have to make right now.
Right now. I like that.
So what tough choice are you going to give me, Steve?
I'm going to assign you to find out what Sheldon Jackson had for breakfast. Because I have no idea.
That would be fascinating. I bet you James Michener figured it out. I bet
you know,
if
he may
reread
have.
Alaska, I bet we'd find out what he wrote.
My mom's a Presbyterian minister, so I have some in ways to that knowledge.
It may be written down someplace. Yeah, but I was just, you know, basically when you were talking about that, trying to find the reality of a person back in history, and I'm thinking, you know, I have really tried to study this whole missionary era, and I've got deep enough in it to get a feeling for Sheldon Jackson in terms of he felt it was really necessary for there to be an educational system for Native children in Alaska. And he was going to get that no matter what. And he decided, well, the churches are supposed to be doing good works. Let's get the churches doing it. And I was realizing, I don't really know this man, even no matter how much I study him. I won't ever really know him. Those times were so different that I'm not really going to ever quite understand why he did the things he did.
And what's fascinating is that that's the same question that's happening now with Native education, and we still don't know the answers. So don't worry. He may not have figured it out, but there is something to say. I mean, one thing you can say about Sheldon Jackson is he had fire burning within him that, I mean, to do the things that he did and the way he did them. And we, I know over on the Bering Sea coast, have a lot to thank him for, because without him and the cutter, the Bear, bringing over the reindeer from the Russian Far East, we would have starved during the turn of the century, last century. So, yeah, who knows what causes people to... I'm sure someone will be sitting around in the future saying, well, you know, I've studied Steve Heimel so much, and I've studied Jack Dalton and Alison Worden so much, and I still don't get what were they thinking?
Why the pink hair? What was she thinking?
My pink hair? Wait a minute.
No,
it's
my
supposed
pink
to be
hair.
Blue. Oh, this is too much fun. I want to find out a little bit more about the two of you, like who you are, for instance. Ladies first, yes.
Okay. I'm Alison Worden. I'm Inupiaq Eskimo. I'm half. My dad's from a small town in Missouri, but I grew up with my mom. They divorced when I was young. I grew up in Fairbanks, Alaska. My family's from a village called Koktovik, Alaska, and also I have family in Barrow. I did spend some summers in Koktovik, and I go back about twice a year now to visit my mom. So I have ties to that to my mom's village, and I call it my own home. And also Anuktuvik Pass, it's like sister villages. I lived in Juneau. I've lived all over the world, London, Memphis, Santa Fe, New York City, Oakland. So I'm a little bit more well-traveled than most of the people from my village.
At what point did you buy into the arts and think of it that this is something I want to try and do with my life?
Well, when I was living in Barrow, I went to high school for a year in Barrow, and I was invited to be a part of a Christmas carol or some silly play, and I was in a role in that, and a small role. And when I moved to junior for my senior year in Juno, I got tied in, pulled into the theater, and then the next thing I know, I was with Perseverance Theater, and I was an actress intern, and that was very lucky and very eye-opening for me. And I kind of got the idea that you can, you know, perform. I had always been around my mom in the church, and they had this choir group, and so they were always performing and singing church songs. So I had grown up in the church with singing, but the whole acting was new to me. And I just never let that let that bug go.
Do you sing?
Yes, I sing
I
and
heard
I rap.
You sing.
I rap.
Really?
We could have rapped this whole interview.
Oh no!
I'm loving it.
She could have rapped it. I would have just sat there with my mouth agape.
You know what is I like? It's very interesting that you the Perseverance Theater figured into this to where you suddenly envisioned yourself knowing how much work it is. And knowing how there's no money in it. I mean, it's just...
They didn't tell me those things. And my rap name is Akumatu, which is two of my Inupiaq names. So, Akumatu. And so when I was in the car before I came here, and whenever I drive around, I'm freestyling and practicing my rhymes.
Excellent. Jack Dalton, you said something about the coast.
Yes. So I'm Jack Dalton, and my mother is originally from the village of Naparachmit or Hooper Bay out on the Bering Sea coast. And then we were actually originally from a smaller village 15 miles north of that called Baimute in the Esquinuk Mountains. And then I was adopted when I was 5 days old, flew to Anchorage, was raised by a non-native family. And essentially my life has been a struggle of identity and who I am and where do I fit in the universe. And in fact, I just got back from Dillingham where I was doing a performance called My Heart Runs in Two Directions at Once, which was about my life and discovering, you know, what it meant to be Native, what it meant to be a Westerner, what it meant to do both those at the same time, and what does this mean for you to do in the world. So I became a storyteller 13 years ago now, and realized the power of our voices, the power of story, and how those two can mix together. And realized that I would spend the rest of my life doing that. And
it's interesting because you almost label yourself Jack Dalton storyteller.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So traditional storytelling, you know, I know some people who tell traditional stories, and there's a lot of tradition involved in how the story is told and which story you're allowed to tell at what age and how much of the story you tell at one sitting and on like that. So tell me, what does this storytelling consist of for you?
I am so glad I'm Yupik because we're so relaxed about everything. all those other cultures that have all these rules, and the Yupiks are looking at them like, okay, who's going to tell this one? Because we kind of ran out of people right now. But I've certainly encountered in my career, because of growing up in the Western world so heavily, I've encountered a lot of people who take issues with my upbringing and then the fact that I see myself as a storyteller. And my almost all the time reaction is, well, when you are my elder and you have the right to tell me that I'm not doing things correctly, then I'll listen to you. But until then, my elders are telling me this is what I'm meant to do, so I'm going to keep doing this. And that's all you can do.
Back at ya.
Woo-woo.
Well done.
I forgot to mention my other passion.
Smack down.
Which is, if I was going to put a label on myself, would be performance artist. So, because performance art and the likes of true performance art, and we just had a show here at Out North with Jose Torres-Tama and Guillermo Gomez-Pena and James Luna. Those type of real performance art is what I aspire, that kind of work to do, because it's really interesting to me.
Well, it's almost a given that rap is going to converge with performance art and slam poetry. Yeah, it probably already has, really.
Yeah, I mean, performance art, to me, just take whatever you have at your disposal, whether it is sculpture or, you know, anything, paintings, multimedia, anything, and throw it at a concept and see what comes out.
And Jack, do you work with props and so forth in your storytelling?
When I'm doing storytelling, usually not, although for this performance, my heart runs in two directions at once. I do use a bench, which is everything from a desk to an airplane seat to storage bins at a museum. But normally it's just me in a blank stage.
And that was another Cyrano's world premiere.
Yes, that was at Cyrano's. And then also, and just to say, I had the pleasure of actually putting on a performance art piece with
Oh, yes, we were Allison in a performance art piece.
Back last May, which was really, it really pushed my boundaries because I put
him in a cage. We built the cage together, but Jack was in a cage like he was in a zoo. And it was called, Wait, Let Me Finish Putting On My Armor. And it was Native people psychologically preparing ourselves for the tourist season. And there were people dressed as tourists, and he was in a cage. He was really, really great in his role of being, he created the signs for the zoo, and there was
no
some different
stations.
No wonder
you get along so well with Luna.
I love James. He's my mentor, actually, James
yeah.
Luna.
Yeah. And that was really interesting because I actually work in the tourism industry, and so me being in that cage and having people ask me questions, I found it really hard to 'cause Allison's like, say whatever you want. If you want to cuss at them, if you want to scream at them, do what you want. And I found it really hard to do that because I've spent 10 years dealing with tourists and answering the most heinous questions in a very diplomatic way.
That is.
But he was really amazing and intense. And it was a fun, we had cardboard cutout Native people. Oh. And behind them, they were being themselves.
So where was this done?
At MTS Gallery. I'm involved with MTS and the Trailer Arts Center. And I was excited. And last summer, it was a lot of fun. It was like 11 of us.
They're very steadfast there at MTS in encouraging performance.
Yes.
So essentially, her seeing my work, working with her and seeing her work, that's when I was asked to make this play, she was the first person I thought of to go and say, help me, I don't know what to do.
And we couldn't have done it without each other's.
Without each other's.
Well, you know it. You know about Stanley Milgram is the psychologist who did the experiment of administering a dose of electricity to the subject on the other side that's an actor, and the person behind the authority figure keeps saying, turn it up. And even though it'll say lethal right on there, they still do it. And he had another one where he made his students get on a New York subway car. I don't know if you've ever been on one of these, but they're very crowded.
Yes.
And ask someone to give their seat to them. And they could not do it. Just like you, Jack, and being in the cage, I could not insult those tourists.
Yeah.
That was very, very well done, Allison.
Oh, thanks. I wish you were there. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
There'll be more of that kind of shows.
Well, it's been a great pleasure having these two playwrights and talented actors and young actors with us on Radio Reader Rambler.
He thinks we're young.
I do. They all look the same to me from where I sit.
Native skin.
We are young. Sacieloel.
Thanks so much for being here. Thank you to Kristen Spock for technical support. I'm Steve Heimel. Radio Reader Rambler will be back next month.